Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 243, featuring a great friend, Ankit Patel from NVIDIA, who is, he's a pretty cool guy, right, Kristen?
Yes, very.
Now, listen, you are my wonderful and faithful producer on the show, and you've been able to do amazing stuff. But you don't necessarily know as much about CG as I do. Mm-mm. This was a hard one for you,
yes.
Right? You listen to this podcast
three
and like,
times.
You listen to the podcast three times? Really?
Yeah. And I Googled everything.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. You didn't just gloss over it.
No.
Wow. Good for you.
It's still coming to me.
Okay. All right. Now he throws out a lot of acronyms, which mm-hmm. I call them out on all
yes.
the time, right? So what were some of the things that you enjoyed about it?
There's a lot of optics, GPU, ray tracing, and deep learning.
Uh-huh.
That was quite...
There's a lot of that.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I did learn that he never gets bored of optics or ray tracing. So
true.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So optics is a new API, not so new API, that's actually now become a very important API for ray tracing and GPU stuff. It is a key factor to what we do for our new V-Ray GPU stuff. It's what's going to be making RTX stuff compatible. I know I'm throwing a bunch of words out there. The thing is, Ankit is a great guy that I've talked to for years, years and years since I started at Chaos Group about interesting GPU stuff. And he is extremely enthusiastic, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he really loves what he does. And so this is one of our most technical podcasts out there.
Yes.
It is. But I think it's really fascinating. If you guys are interested in understanding about GPU technology and about NVIDIA and what they're doing with their GPUs and how it affects the entire world, including ray tracing and deep learning, this is a really great podcast. This was recorded at SIGGRAPH,
mm-hmm.
so a few months ago. But really great podcast, and I'm really excited we're able to put it out there. Okay, we've got a couple of announcements. What's going on? You've got all the notes.
I do. Okay, so you can get all this information on chaosgroup.com/events.
Right.
So October 3rd through 5th, State of Art is holding their Academy Days in Venice, Italy.
Mm-hmm.
And then here in Hollywood, ASAI is holding their Architecture in Perspective event.
Yes.
Yeah, that's going to be really fun. Mm-hmm. That's going to be at the Kimpton Everly Hotel October 3rd through 5th. Mm-hmm. And you will be moderating a panel at Noman on October 3rd.
I will, mm-hmm. which would be really great. This is, I think the president this year for ASAI is Keely Koglu from Killigraph. And so she's a wonderful person and she's really got involved in this. And she came up to me and asked me to be on a panel. So I'm very excited to do that. I'm literally doing that 2 days after I get back from THU. So it's going to be a little rough, but I will be there in spirit. I should note that we're actually recording this podcast while I am at THU. This is when this is coming out. It's coming out while I'm at THU, but we're recording it a little bit before then. So those of you guys who are going to be at THU, I'd love to, if you're listening to this while you're at THU, put down your headphones and go to and have fun at THU and listen to it afterwards. All right, what else is going on?
All right, we do have a couple other things. So mm-hmm. October 3rd through 6th in Warsaw, Poland, it's going to be Archi Day 2019.
Mm-hmm.
So join Chaos Group, our CG artist Anastasia, at the Warsaw Home Expo, and you can discover how easy it is to create great-looking imagery with V-Ray for SketchUp.
Oh, nice, yes.
And then also, we are still doing our call for speakers for Total Chaos 2020. If you go to chaosgroup.com/become a speaker, we have shortened this from last week, so it's super easy now.
Right.
Again, we're looking for talented artists and developers who have a vision to share or unique perspective on the newest developments in computer graphics.
That's right. chaosgroup.com/become a speaker. Remember that link? It's much easier to remember. All right. Great. So like I said, I will be at THU. I am at THU as if this recording, but it would be great to see you guys there. If you guys want to hang out, whatever, just message me. You guys know how to get in touch with me. If you guys want to get in touch with the podcast, where are some of the places we can look for?
All right. So you can go to facebook.com/CG Garage Podcast.
Mm-hmm.
You can also go to chaosgroup.com/CG Garage.
Right.
And then to email us, just email labs@chaosgroup.com.
All right. Thanks so much, guys. With that being said, enjoy this amazing podcast with Ankit Patel from NVIDIA.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
You and I started working together on some weird stuff like 5 years ago.
Way back, yeah.
Yeah. So, the thing that I've been thinking about, because it, you know, that was 5 years ago, Sigraf, and I believe it was, what else? We were doing all kinds of stuff. It was at Sigraf in LA, I think. And it was the first time sort of doing a GPU project, and you were helping me in terms of getting GPUs going. And, you know, we had done, actually, I think it was 4 years ago, we took 32 GPUs, we're using 4 VCAs to do...
Construct, right?
Construct, to do real-time ray tracing in Motion Builder, right, on the cloud. And it was a massive amount of work that we did to do that. And it was really cool. Like, it was like, whoa, we can actually ray trace live now. And then fast forward to now, 4 years later, we're doing it even better on a laptop.
Yeah. it's been a lot going on.
Yeah, but in 4 years, I mean, think about that. That's a massive change. So let's talk about that evolution a little bit of what you've been thinking about GPUs for the last, you know, 5 years, and how every generation keeps really sort of not just getting better and better, but seems to be really well geared towards ray tracing. So there's been a path towards ray tracing in the last several years. What's the focus of that? Why is that?
I think a couple of things, right? The GPU's always been good at shading. GPU has always kind of been a good shading machine.
Mm-hmm.
But all calculating the traversal, the intersection stuff, doing it on the SM, that's been one of the sort of takes more time. And
right.
So we kind of been trying to crack that problem. We've been trying to crack that problem for many, many years, like probably ever since I started NVIDIA.
Yeah.
And I wasn't even working on that at the time.
Yeah.
But the other thing is just memory, right? Memory's been always important. It's like, oh, how can I get these scenes? How can I load it in? How can I get enough GPU memory,
right?
And so the memory curve's been going up. And you know, recently we just did a big algorithms have been doing a bunch of the work on GPU
right.
to get us to better, faster intersection thing. And then we kind of changed that curve by adding our RT cores last year.
Right. Explain the GPU.
Sorry. Oh, sorry, that term general purpose GPU kind of, or is it? What's it? I forget. I think it's general purpose, but it's basically like CUDA, not you're using a programmable shader, not to create a shader, but you're using it for just general purpose. For
general purpose, yeah. Right. So CUDA basically...
CUDA was a big deal.
It's
yeah.
a big deal.
Yeah.
And then last year, the big thing was the RTX cores, right? Or the RT cores.
Yeah, the RT cores.
Right.
Yeah, the RT cores were a big... Because that was the whole... I was talking about shading being, you know, kind of this... You know, mm-hmm. GPU is good at shading, but
right.
GPU is not so great at traversal because you had to do it in... software, and it was good.
Right.
It was good at it, but not, you know, the best it could be.
Right.
So adding these RT cores basically says, hey, you know, now we're really good at traversal. Now shading's a problem again. But you know,
okay.
It's kind of like bottleneck shift.
You think there's a bottleneck shift because the shading is actually going to be is slower now than the ray tracing part of it.
It's just gotten so fast. Like we did this. Traversal used to be the slower part.
Right.
And now traversal so fast that it's overtaken.
The shading.
Shading is now the slower part, right?
Is there going to be an effort in terms of the shading portion of things that's happening next? It has to be.
I mean, there's a lot of algorithm stuff. This is the interesting thing that's now that it's out there,
right.
And we put out, then there's the APIs, right? There's DXR, there's Vulkan, there's Optix, and all these APIs are out there that
right.
people can innovate on top of
right.
and do all sorts of creative things like Lavina, right?
Right.
Like Lavina's taken advantage
right.
of DXR, kind of rethinking the algorithm of, hey, how do we solve this, like, let me rethink the problem. Now that I have this crazy horsepower with traversal,
right?
How can I, you know, rethink of a system that can be super fast, real time?
So that's actually a good point. There are actually several parts to this, right? Because obviously the hardware is getting faster and faster. The silicone itself is fast. Memory is also another big thing. You guys added the HBM2 memory, which is like significantly faster, right? And that allowed for like NVLink.
Memory link, memory capacity, NVLink, right? Yeah. GPU Direct.
Yeah.
There's like all these things that we've been doing and just continue to, I think the whole thing's like a system, right? And then the bottleneck moves around in the system. It's like, if you optimize this, now you've got to go, okay, well, now we made a bottleneck over here. Okay, so we got to go optimize that. Now there's a bottleneck over here. Let's go work on that.
Right.
It's a never-ending problem.
So, but you also, like you mentioned, you says, then you've got all these APIs. And there's actually several of them.
Yeah.
So,
so they all share. So yeah. I know it sounds, oh my gosh, which... But they're all driver APIs that share a common core.
Okay.
So it's like saying, hey, these are different dialects of the same core language type thing. Think of it like that conceptually. They're actually quite similar, but like DXR is very DirectX. It speaks in a DirectX style of programming. It's you know, more nurtured to that, right? In terms of its HLSL shaders and et cetera, Vulkan. Ray tracing has the Vulkan extensions, SPUR-V. Optics is CUDA.
Right.
Focus, it's like, hey, you're using CUDA-C to write your shaders, things like that.
So, but isn't there also like, you know, like for example, if you're going DXR, for example, that's going to be much more geared towards Windows, right? Obviously.
Yeah. But, yes, of course. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
But Vulkan is going to be more universal, and Optics is...
So Optics works in Windows... Linux,
yeah.
But then it also has things like, so Optics supports IBM Power.
What's that?
So IBM Power is a different type of processor. So you have Intel makes x86 processors.
Yes.
And AMD makes x86 processors.
Yes.
And then ARM makes processors.
Right. Yeah.
IBM makes processors.
Okay.
The Power processors, actually. So they're used in high performance computing.
That's more for supercomputing.
Yeah, supercomputers use that, right?
Right.
And so, yeah, people use, I don't know if you know John Stone, but he's one of these guys in HPC land. We see, we see him around, and he does scientific visualization stuff, right? It's, hey, I got this molecule or this chromatophore that's going to, they use it for some health, you know, this is the cancer gene or some stuff like that, and they want to visualize it.
Right.
And these things are so huge because they're simulated. Right. I think like a procedural simulation, right? These things are massive. So actually ray trace them because it's faster to ray trace than to rasterize.
Interesting.
And so, yeah, for some of these things, like, hey, there's ray tracing. Because the ambient occlusion and things kind of helps them to figure out how...
What it looks like.
Yeah.
Interesting.
That's a world I know a little bit about, but not in... just a little bit.
Well, okay, well, let's get into that. Like, how did you... What ended up getting you into NVIDIA? What was that little journey that got you into that role?
Oh, to NVIDIA or just to, like...
Just, let's start, let's go to... Let's see how you got to NVIDIA.
Oh, wow. Well, yeah, NVIDIA's... So I joined NVIDIA, like, I was at Blackmagic before that.
Okay.
And I joined NVIDIA, I was finishing school, and there was an opportunity. I was like, okay, they wanted me to help them with... We had an SDI business at NVIDIA.
Okay, you know, SDI.
Serial Digital Interface, like it's in broadcast.
Okay.
So they use this SDI in, because the idea there, again, another, how do we get low latency video into the GPU?
Right.
And so we're like, how do we do that? And so we actually had this technology and we actually created SDI cards, and they brought me in to manage those cards and things. We abandoned that now in the senses, and we kind of built it.
Right.
And then we let our partners
take
over. And so we have all these I/O partners that take advantage of GPU Direct to basically get SDI signals directly into GPU memory.
Okay.
Low latency into video. GPU memory. That's the way you think about it. Yeah. Low latency video in GPU memory. Once it's there, you can do all sorts of stuff.
You can process it fast.
Yeah. So if you watch the news and things like that, and you see these, you know, they got these real time things where they're putting, I don't know, water. They're talking about the weather, and the guy's like, hey, now there's water on set and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
And the graphics that you see for sports events and things like that,
that's
a bunch of that goes through that type of technology.
Okay. So that's what you got.
That's how I got in, because I come from that world.
You come from that world. So you come from the video technology world and the broadcast world a little bit. Yeah. Okay.
So yeah, ray tracing was a little bit like, I kind of heard about it, but I didn't really know about it. But actually the funny thing with the NVIDIA, back to the history of things.
Yeah.
So I started there, and then I didn't stay there that long, because NVIDIA is a fun place that way, where it's like, hey, you know, we're working on this project, this virtualization thing.
Uh-huh.
You know, we're gonna virtualize the GPU and put it in a VM. And I was like, wait, I know nothing about this stuff. This
right.
is like, you want somebody from VMware or something like that that
right, right, right.
kind of lives in this world.
Right.
They're like, no, but you know, why do you want to try? Do you want to work on it?
Right.
I'm gonna be a product manager for it.
Said, okay.
Okay.
All right.
I go, you might not hire me to do this, but if you're willing to give me a chance, sure.
Sure. Okay.
And that's what's awesome about NVIDIA. And I've been, and I kind of, that pattern has repeated.
Right.
So I worked on Grid. So Grid is now vGPU.
Right.
So all our vGPU stuff, it was, I started working on that like on the ground floor.
Right.
And that's what evolved into VCA, because we were out there on stage with Jensen
right.
going, hey, we have this virtualized system
right.
where you can say, all right, for an artist, you could give them one GPU, you could give them two GPUs, you could give them four GPUs.
Right.
Or you could, you know, kind of like scale that system.
So that was the beginning of using multiple GPUs to do the same task.
Yeah, so the way we think, of, yes, to use multiple GPUs to do the same task. I mean, the language I use nowadays is we say weak scaling versus strong scaling.
Okay.
So what I mean by
explain
that.
Explain by that.
Yeah, I'll explain it. So when we say strong scaling, it's basically take a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Like, actually, I'll put it in rendering terms.
Okay.
So when I want to render a huge billboard, like it's, you know, we're talking 4K,
mm-hmm.
32K.
Right.
This is a 32K by 32K resolution. You want to render this big thing.
Right.
So you want to take that frame and you want to kind of share it across multiple GPUs, across multiple resolutions.
Right.
That's strong scaling.
Right.
Weak scaling is, okay, I have this HD and I have 8,000 frames.
Right.
Right. And I want to render these 8,000 frames.
Mm-hmm.
So I can, the difference is like strong scaling is pretty hard because now you're trying to get people, all these things to work on the same problem.
Right.
And sometimes there's only enough space. Like imagine you have a puzzle,
mm-hmm.
500 piece puzzle, and you had 500 people standing around it.
Right.
How would they put that puzzle together?
That's an excellent point.
That's
a
hard problem, right?
Yeah.
There's requires a certain amount of
coordination
and things, yeah. right? That's a difficult problem.
That's a very
Whereas if you say, hey, I have 500 piece, well, I guess it's not a puzzle, it's a different thing. Like I have 500 pieces to move from here to there.
Right.
Right.
And then you can
say, all right, everybody take one piece, move it from here to there.
Right.
And it's different, right? It's not like trying to put the puzzle together. This is just general moving.
Right.
So if I had to render 8,000 frames, I can say, okay, if I have 8 GPUs, okay, GPU one, you do
one,
frame one,
two.
You do frame two,
yeah.
frame three, frame four.
Yeah.
Okay,
we're used to that.
Just that's typical batch.
Okay.
Rendering. So that's strong scaling versus weak scaling.
So strong scaling is the more challenging one. And so you guys had the ability that you can get multiple GPUs to scale together.
We've been, trying to push on that problem, right?
Right. And I remember very specifically with Vlado, he had been telling me when you were first like adding GPUs, like one, two, and he goes like, this scales surprisingly well. Like you know, two GPUs was getting you almost exactly two times the speed, and then eight GPUs was getting you very close to eight times the speed.
A lot of that, I mean, that's credit to Vlado.
Yeah.
Because there's things that are part of the hardware, part of the system, right? The actual
uh-huh.
PCI Express bandwidth matters.
Yeah.
NVLink matters because of the bandwidth between GPUs because you're copying over buffers and
mm-hmm.
how you split the work. But a bunch of that is up to how the algorithm takes advantage of it.
Right.
So like Vlado did a great job saying, okay, how am I going to divide the work and what's going to happen
right.
and things, right? So there's a software and a hardware component to this stuff.
Right.
Understanding the system architecture and understanding where the system throughput, where the bottlenecks are, right? Is it on storage? Do I copy to host? Do I move it here? How much can I keep it? Because you want a typical thinking when you're programming in GPUs, you will say, okay, I want to take stuff from host.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so host memory, I mean CPU memory,
mm-hmm.
device memory, I mean GPU memory.
Right.
And so you want to do one at, you don't want to go back and forth between the two.
Once
you get on GPU, you want to stay on GPU.
Let's,
once you're on host, you want to stay on host for a while. You know, you want to kind of minimize
take,
that.
Let's talk about that problem because that's obviously been the problem, right? You mentioned the fact that, you know, I remember when we first started Construct, we got the K6000s. That's when we started. That's how long ago it was.
Yeah, Kepler.
Kepler, right?
Actually, and funny enough, I don't even, the optics doesn't even support, I think the minimum is Maxwell now.
Really?
yeah,
so the Kepler cards.
Actually, I know the minimum is Maxwell.
Okay, well, that's good to know. And Maxwell's are still great cards.
Yeah, just because it's like, they you can still use the same API and they support, they
right.
don't have RT cores, but you can use the same API and run the software, at least it'll work.
Right. So those K6000s, they had 12 gigs of memory, right? That was huge at the time.
Yeah.
Because I think nothing had more than like four before that, right?
No, I don't remember because I joined NVIDIA just at Fermi, and Kepler was new when I joined. So
okay.
It could be. But yeah, you're right. It was small.
It was small. But 12 was enough.
12 was a milestone.
12 was a milestone. You were like, oh, we can fit a lot more on this before. Because most people were like, not really going to be able to do much with, I can do a little look dev, but I'm not going to do final frame, right? So these Kepler cards were the first one we go, we can do final frame stuff on this. And that's when we challenged Kevin to do that. And it's like, hey, Kevin, you know, what do you think about doing this? And so Kevin's never turns down a challenge, but it was really kind of, it was cool. It was really interesting that that we were able to do that. But there was always that thing, right? So because we had thought about like, how do you, when you run out, even if you get to 12, there's still a limitation there. So you have to think, well, if I go beyond 12, I have to take stuff out of memory and put it onto the device.
Yes.
Onto the
host.
The host, thank you. The host. And that means the RAM on the CPU RAM. And once it's there, I guess it's okay. But it's the trip between the two that becomes the
best.
It's
just slower, right? It slows it down a bit. So actually, there was a point where it wasn't, if it fell off of that 12, it was a cliff. You were dead. You just couldn't do anything.
Right.
Now the algorithms have evolved.
Right.
Where even, you know, where you can page in what you need, and you can get in the mipmap levels that you need.
Right.
And so you're smarter about an algorithm to load from. And it's like different tiers, right? You load from disk to host to device, and there's algorithms that you use to say, okay, wait, I'm just going to pull in what I need, and then I'm going to throw away the stuff that I'm not going to need for a while. And you can do that sort of asynchronously to kind of maintain performance and things. So there's things that people are doing. I mean, you guys are doing that.
Right.
That's actually, and back to Lavina as an example, but even in V-Ray, right? Like, those are massive scenes that he's rendering in Lavina. How's he doing that? It's like, yeah, he's doing a lot of dynamic stuff.
Actually, no. It's all in RAM. It's all on device. The massive scenes we're doing is because we're doing pure ray tracing. And by doing pure, by doing pure ray tracing, we don't have the same. We don't need. We can instance like crazy.
Yeah.
So we can put in. We put 300 billion polygons in there. It's a lot of instancing, but you can't do that on a rasterized rendering. So that's kind of like showing that this is really ray tracing.
Right.
So and it scales really well. The other thing that's nice about the ray tracing is that it scales really well. So you can throw more geometry at it. It doesn't slow down the way that a rasterized render would when you throw more geometry at it.
Way I think about that is like a rasterizer, basically resolution's free.
Right.
On a ray tracer, it's like the triangles are free, right?
Like,
I mean, it's roughly, it's not.
That's a great analogy.
That's just a simple, because you can just keep, and the resolution will cost you. You go on a ray tracer, you go from, you know, 2K to 4K, ooh, that hurts.
Yeah, it does. It does.
Hurts a lot more.
Right, it hurts more. It's an excellent point. But I want to go back to the memory, because the memory was part of the evolution. Like, you know, how much more can we get? How much more can we get? And so we got this. And now I know that we can get all the way to the RTX 8000s. Those have 48 gigs
per card, and you could put two of them together with NVLink.
I know.
It's like, whoa.
I want to go to the NVLink in a second, but just like now we can get 48 gigs of memory on a card.
Yep.
And I think that's the biggest you guys have right now, right?
That is the biggest single card. Well, and then, okay, so that's the biggest single PCI Express card. I mean, we have systems like the DGX2, which is designed in such a way that's like, you think of it like one GPU with 512 gigs of
memory.
But actually, I'm going to sidebar here for a second. Yeah. I think one of the things that pushed some of the memory things is like this heavy investment in deep learning and all the interest in it and all the demand for GPUs off of that. Actually, deep learning has similar requirements as some of the ray tracing stuff, right? They kind of overlap. Because of that, you end up getting, like, it's easier to kind of push the envelope for everybody who's like, hey, you know, you get basic economies of scale at that point, right? It's like, you see that demand comes in, all that stuff, and now you're just seeing GPUs with bigger memories.
Right. Okay, so I want to get back to deep learning, because that's a big part of what you guys have been able to accomplish. But the other one I want to talk about is, so we went for a lot more memory now, but then there was another evolution that happened. Was it at Maxwell that you guys created HBM2 memory?
No, it was Pascal.
Pascal, right. So HBM2, you guys went from a certain kind of memory to a new kind of memory, and that was revolutionary in terms of the speed of the memory, right?
It was, yes. I don't think I get into enough of the detail there, okay. But I know. I mean, just because I don't know, I'm
right, right.
Not because I don't want to tell right. you, but it's just, it was faster memory.
Much faster.
It was faster memory, and we called it stacked memory, and right. it was basically like, it was really a bandwidth,
exactly.
throughput memory, right? Like it was just really, really fast.
Really fast.
Yeah.
And the other,
but it was very expensive.
Yeah. Probably still is, or is it coming down? I don't know.
I'm not sure. It's like I think like our
because the first one is like significantly more expensive.
Yeah, then there was like there was that because then we were at GDDR5 back then. I think.
Right.
Now it's GDDR6, and then there was like a wide bus something in the middle there. So I'm not like up to speed on memory speeds and all the different memory technologies, but like there's these competing technologies, and they sort of kind of both advance. We end up using the HBM stuff in our big HPC type GPUs, and then we use the kind of more mainstream stuff in our Turing architecture that you see today.
Right. So the other thing that we're going back to like your analogy of the board, right? So if the memory is on the device, going through that PCI lane back to another card would have slowed it down a lot, right? So that's why you could only, like, let's say you had two GPUs back in the old days.
Yeah.
When you had two GPUs, one is 12 gigs, the other one's 12 gigs. You couldn't load a 24 gig scene because that would mean you would have to share memory between two cards, and the PCI lane was too slow to do that, and it would slow down the rendering too much, right?
You could do it, but I know what you mean, right? So your limit so PCI Express, let's say, is 12 gigabyte per second, 15, theoretical, right? So what would happen is if I'm GPU A, and I want to read something from GPU B, in the past, it wasn't possible. I had to go through host. So forget that for a second. At least now we have GPU Direct, where I can read directly the other GPU's memory.
Right.
So now that goes over PCI Express. I'm going to read at 12 gigabytes per second.
Okay.
Right, that's my read speed.
Which sounds fast, but it's not.
Yeah, but if it depends. Yeah, is that moving enough, right? And how often and how frequent? And then it's not just the speed. There's the latency that matters too.
Right.
Like, what's the how many milliseconds does it take me, or actually microseconds?
Right.
Would it take me to get that information?
So then you guys invented your own bus that goes on top of the card.
Correct.
Which is NVLink.
Correct.
And then suddenly now you can take two cards, but you can take, let's take your old 12 gig cards and you make them 24. But now you can take 248 gig cards and make them 96 gigs of memory.
Yeah. Yep.
Which is a lot of memory. Yep.
Yeah, and that's why this is what I was saying, the DGX system. Like on the PCI cards, we have an NVLink bridge that connects two cards together.
Right.
On like some of the DGX systems, we actually connect, like the NVLink connects multiple cards directly.
Right.
So you don't
have. And that's done on the motherboard.
It's done on the motherboard.
Yeah.
It's a different.
It's a whole different architecture.
Yeah, it's a big different architecture.
So that's pretty amazing. But that's an expensive piece of machine, right?
Yeah.
That's not someone in his basement doing architecture rendering is not going to buy one of those things.
Not in the basement. No. But it's interesting to see what you could do with that, right?
Like
that system actually is quite amazing in what you can do with it for these deep learning problems, right?
Right.
It's like these models, they take a long time to train, long time to do these things, like training's and this just crunches through that work. Like things that used to take, imagine it would take you a month or months on a GPU. Now you're like put on a system like this and you're doing it in days or hours. Like these are the scales we're talking about.
Right.
There's not seconds. Now we're in ray tracing and stuff. Now we're talking in, real time.
Right.
We're talking frames per second.
Right.
Deep learning's not there yet.
Yeah. But what, everything now, I mean, I went to SIGGRAPH, right? Mm-hmm. And I went to a bunch of papers, right? Not a single paper, not a single technical presentation, not any innovation that's happened at the SIGGRAPH that was announced this year, every single one of them had a component of machine learning in them. Mm. Every single one.
There you go.
And I think that machine learning has been around for a long time.
What was your favorite paper? Which one did you?
There was some really interesting ones. I got it's a little all over the place. I did go see. What's her name? The woman who did the imaging of the black hole. That was
That was pretty incredible. You know that black hole image that came out in April?
Yeah, no, I know, but yeah. So there's some drama around that. It's like there's some people trying to take credit and
she credited everyone.
Yeah, that's good.
Me.
Yeah.
She credited everyone on this.
Visualize the black hole, yeah.
So, but that was kind of interesting because obviously there was a little bit of learning going on in that as well, because you basically had to take a noisy image and figure out the best guess as to what the actual image is.
Yeah.
It was really fascinating. But there was another guy I met who was in France, and it was an image synthesis problem. And basically what he did is, the idea is that when you go to a famous place, tourist place or whatever, and you see a beautiful picture that some professional photographer has done with a beautiful sunset. But when you go there, it's like 12 o'clock and it's not very pretty, but you take a picture. So you can take that picture and then based on learning, he uses machine learning to learn a lot about the area.
Yeah.
He can relight the entire scene with any lighting you want.
Huh. So this is like it's a painting.
No, it's not a painting.
It's just a picture. So
a picture and then you derive geometry from the picture and then you relight the scene.
Oh, photogrammetry type thing.
But it's all, he does a lot of the photogrammetry. He tries to understand the scene by learning from it. He tries to understand the geometry by looking at the shadows.
Yeah.
And it's
Very cool.
And it was all ML. So it's pretty, and there was every single one of them. It was like, or another one was some guy created a makeshift light stage with way fewer components, fewer pictures, fewer lighting conditions, and then interprets all the in-betweens through machine learning. And so
it's interesting. I mean, sometimes this is, you know, there's I heard this recently. Someone's like, machine learning, or they say AI,
right,
is gonna, it allows us to solve the unsolvable problems. It's like, you know.
I don't know, because the thing about machine learning is that it's your best guess. Or
it's basically the statistically likelier. Here's
the most probable.
Most probable. Yeah, exactly.
It's not the actual solution.
It's not. It's the statistical probability.
Right.
That's what a lot of that is. Like, okay, well, it's an approximation.
Right.
But
it works.
It works. And it's like, you know, you can't, for a lot of situations, it's actually amazing.
Right. Yeah.
You couldn't get there just too much artists. Actually, the Gauguin stuff, you saw that?
Yeah.
So like we won a bunch of awards on that.
Explain that, yeah.
Oh, sorry, okay. So Gauguin, play on the thing there, but the GAN part is the general adversarial network.
Uh-huh.
And so there's two parts of this network where you have, one is kind of creating something, and then the other part is kind of saying, no, it's not realistic enough. And so this is the discriminator.
Right.
And so Gauguin, I mean, for the artist experience of it, let's get into the details of it, but the artist experience is, hey, I put some brush strokes with just basic colors, matte colors. Like, I want some sky here, I want some mountains here, I want some grass here.
And then you do that as a color.
You do that as color.
Listen, you represent it as a color.
Yeah, this looks like Atari,
right?
Like color.
Right, yeah.
Then what the AI does, the GAN, so the GAN is the type of network. So the AI that's basically takes that and produces what it thinks is kind of realistic looking landscape.
Right.
And it's just like, and it's kind of fun. It's doing it real time. So as you're doing this, it's like you're getting that feedback loop.
Yeah.
We're like, oh, let me change this. And you could change lighting conditions. You could do some stuff.
Right.
So it's pretty cool for concept art. So what's the interesting thing is, you know, we put this thing out there.
Right. Well,
now we put it on our AI playground on NVIDIA.com. If you go AI playground, you can actually go do it yourself.
Nice.
And what's cool is that there's some artists that kind of picked it up.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of these artists on our side, he's like, oh, this is pretty cool. And, you know, kind of asked some of his friends to check it out. And the thing that people kind of make the mistake is, oh, this is going to replace artists. Like, no. An artist, to create that thing that you see at the end that's beautiful, that you think, oh my gosh, that's amazing.
Yeah.
They spent a bunch of time doing what they would consider kind of like grunty stuff.
Yes.
And then they spend the rest of the time doing the real art.
Right.
So the idea here is that, hey, it would take you 4 hours or 8 hours to get this starting point, and then, you know, you spend another 4 hours to make it amazing.
Right.
This gets you that 4 or 8 hours of initial work in 5 minutes.
Yeah, you're still 100% creative.
You are.
But it's you're not doing the you're what you you don't necessarily need the technical expertise of knowing how to paint.
Yeah, it's like I need some rocks.
Right.
Like if I'm gonna go create rocks in Photoshop, it's gonna take me like, and I'm not really an artist that way, but I'm talking to these artists like, yeah, it'll take me a couple hours to do that.
Right.
With this, I can just say, give me some rocks, and it gives me close enough, mm-hmm. and I can go tweak them.
Right.
And it's faster for me to do that than to, you know, just it's so it's the idea is that it's supposed to help artists be creative and move things along, right? Like give them more time to be creative instead of doing some of that.
So there's a guy who's a friend of mine, and he actually came to Total Chaos in Sofia and presented. His name is Scott Eaton, mm-hmm. and he's like an expert in anatomy, right?
Okay.
So he is, and he's an incredible artist as well. But he also has a site where he has photographs of people, tons and tons of people for reference, right? So different poses, different things, body shapes, all that kind of stuff, all this anatomy stuff. And he got interested in it and decided with machine learning that he basically did very similar to what you guys did there, but all with human bodies.
Okay.
So he took thousands and thousands and thousands of pictures of people, right? But he decided with a fresh start, and he's because with machine learning, you can actually constrain it to only learn what you want it to learn, right?
Yeah, people call that bias, but keep going.
But he wanted bias, yes.
Oh, he wanted the bias.
He wanted the bias, right? Because he wanted it based on his photographs, his models, his lighting conditions.
It's personalized.
Yes, right? So there's an artist choice there.
It's his style.
Before you even started the training, right?
I see.
So the bias was a...
He's curating his data. That's fine. That's normal.
Right.
He's basically... Exactly. Because he's trying to teach the AI his style.
Right. So he did all these photographs of these people. And then he did a very simple, like, you know, sketch to pick machine learning, right?
Oh, yeah, I've seen some of that stuff.
So,
yeah.
But, you know, instead of doing, you know, sketch to cat, which was the first one, right? Instead of doing that, he did it from he'll train it basically on a photograph of a person and then an outline of that person, right?
Right.
And then train. And he used that all GPU stuff, obviously. Yep. And then he would just start to draw.
And then it would,
and they would create a human, but because he was curating it, he started to draw people in very different styles, like not proportionally unusual, and it would create a photo. It'd make a photographic person like that, or he would just draw a circle, and then you would get this blob of flesh. And it was, and what was interesting because it was his style again, what was important, like no matter what he did, it was always toplet, like it actually figured out where to put the lighting. It would shadow, like if someone was bent over like this, the thigh, you know, and everything, and he could do all this stuff. Anyway, it turned it snowballed into something absolutely amazing, and he created a gallery out of it. He had art openings, and it's all based on machine learning.
That's interesting.
That's his own style. And very, very artistic to the point, like, I would never have thought of something like this, right?
This is pretty cool.
So when you're saying that machine learning is going to replace the artists, I think it's going to create some amazing stuff.
It's going to, we think of it like, you know, AI helps, you know, gives us superpowers, right? Mm-hmm. Lets us do things that we want to do.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I was just thinking about, you have the architecture of background. So I did this architect that he did a blog for us and stuff. It's called Archie Gann. Architectural Gann.
Yes.
But the interesting thing here is that he used multiple networks and he has a human intervening between the steps. So you might have to teach me some of this stuff, but
go ahead.
So what apparently there's a relationship between a plot of land and the type of building you put on it, like the actual outline of the building.
Yes.
Like there's some relation there.
Yep.
So he has a network that basically you give it a plot of land and it gives you back a recommended outline.
Sure.
And then you can go and edit and tweak that outline and, you know, you go change different things on it. So as a human, you can go and it's all looks like just colors, two, three colors, right? You just...
Right.
And so you can affect that. And then you take that...
Right.
And then you give it to another network.
Okay.
And in this other network, it comes back and it says, hey, I've put your walls and your windows and doors and all that stuff for you. So it does the rest, it does that part for you. So a recommended floor plan.
Right.
Because apparently once you have a building outline, you can do a recommended floor plan around it. And then, but the human can interact there as well, because then you can go, wait a minute, no, I want a window here.
Right.
I want, you know, the door should be over here. This is really the front. And you can kind of lock in some constraints and you kind of iterate with the network and you say, you know,
and you can continue to train it, obviously, and do all that.
Right. So, well, this one was already trained, but then you can go in, and then now it's giving you that, and then there's another network that does furniture, and he's continuing to move it on to say, hey, you know, what if I was designing an apartment building, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, Archigan, it's a blog on our dev blog site, and it's pretty cool. But the thing that I thought was very good about it was that you have the architect or the human, basically kind of instructing it
at which phase of it
at the different steps,
but you know, it's, I hate to say this, but it's not, isn't it, this not dissimilar from, like, let's say you know, a big head designer of an architecture firm says, all right, here, come up with some ideas of how we're going to lay this out, I'll see you later, right? And then,
is that what happens?
It does. So there's a more junior designer who's like trying to figure out some different layouts and stuff like that. And then he was like, oh, right, you know, let's do that, you know, and then, or no, let's do that, but let's move this here and let's, yeah, great, let's keep moving. And then it goes to the next step. There's always going to be someone that sort of
does a little bit of the grunt work.
Right. Yeah. And so it is kind of interesting to think about it that way. But if you can accelerate that process, or sometimes, you know, end up with results that you don't necessarily think of, you know, that's also.
Yeah. Like some of the generative design. This is actually similar in the concept, but like some of the stuff that in the manufacturing space, right? There's this, you ever seen those funky looking things that look like they're from aliens or whatever, but then they're just way more structurally sound, like a rim of a car is like 3D printed, and it's all like mesh and organic looking.
And they try to make it,
That's pretty, it's like, we are not think, an artist is thinking of that, but we're not, engineers don't think of that as being like, like the structure that they would put. And then it's like, it's actually stronger and uses less material.
Yep.
And so it's better. It's like, but it just looks like, some of that stuff looks, wow.
So, it's get, how the last several years, obviously, NVIDIA has really, really started to branch out from its roots. Its roots, I think, are, you know, or what was, NVIDIA was really well known for video games and the GeForce cards, et cetera, right? So that part where it goes, we could use GPUs for other things as well, and suddenly that kind of exploded, right? But that root of the video game world and the is kind of where it started, right?
I guess I wasn't at NVIDIA really then,
right?
But yeah, the roots, I mean, gaming is strong,
right?
Gaming is strong for, like, there's a lot of people who love games, and just, I think, gaming in general, like, you, I don't know how many video games you played as a child, but
a lot.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of people, it's funny, it's like, and a lot of people I talk to now, you know, these really smart engineers that are designing architectures and that are like thinking about algorithms and stuff.
Right.
It's like, what got you interested in computers and in graphics and all that stuff? And, you know, a lot more often than not, it's video games.
Video games.
It's like you started playing these video games, like, you start breaking, it's like, hey, I wonder how that's made. I'd like to make some of that. And then you get into it, and it's like, And then their computer graphics engineers working at NVIDIA.
But Jensen was, that's how he, that was his roots too, right? Like he's founded the company.
Yeah.
That's rare for a company that mature for someone to still be like the CEO.
Oh yeah, the CEO founder is kind of a, yeah.
Yeah, it's a big deal. And
there's a few of them, right? There's Jensen, there's Jeff Bezos.
Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk.
Elon Musk, yeah.
Those are big names.
Yeah.
So, and I remember, you know, when you know, I remember one of the first first GPU I bought, because when I was in grad school, we had SGIs, and it was like, this has, you know, very expensive proprietary graphics system. And then suddenly, like, you got this little card.
Took it home, put it in.
Took it home, and my computer is like, this is even faster. But I don't understand how that's possible. And then that was the big thing, right? So it was like the whole Riva to all that stuff, right? And then these GeForce cards evolved, and became very, very powerful and very well known. But does Jensen still, like, get involved in, like, making hardware? Because he obviously is a hardware, like, he knows.
He's,
a,
He's one of the smartest people.
Really?
Yeah. It just he's involved in a lot of things.
Right.
Right. He has this great ability to go deep.
Right.
On almost anything.
Right.
Like whether it's marketing or HR things or like GPU architecture or the next deep learning thing. He's just really, really great.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's a really cool thing. But I remember it was reason I'm bringing it up is because you and I were meeting at Limelight. I don't remember which one it was. Maybe it was 2 years ago or last year. But he had, you were showing me the Lewis version of the optics denoiser. It was like brand new, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. It was a couple of years ago. Yeah.
And then you were like, check it out. And I was like, whoa, denoising. Okay. All right. Well, I've seen part of it, but it's really cool. And it's like, it's running really fast. And he goes, yeah. And I looked down and there was this very cool looking tower that you guys had.
The DGX
station, right?
Yeah.
And I was like, whoa, what's that? And then you were like, you opened it up for me. I was like, this is really cool tower. And it says, who makes it? And you said, we do. I was like, who designed it? Because it was really pretty. And he goes, well, Jensen was heavily involved in the design of this thing. And it's like, I find it kind of amazing.
Yeah, he has a good, there's an aesthetic. He also, mm-hmm. like, everything we put out there is communicating our company,
right?
Our team. And honestly, we want to, the team, the engineers, they just work really hard,
right?
They just work really hard on doing the best they can.
Right.
And so we always want to be good about making sure that we honor their work.
Right.
And kind of present their work in the best light, right? So we kind of want to make sure that that thing was on a pod and it was shown and they did a good job designing it. And of course, I always say Jensen was involved because they go show it to Jensen and say, hey, Jensen, what do you think? I mean, part of it, it's like, when you're, I'm not sure this is the best analogy, but it's like when you do something and you're like proud of your work, you want to go show it to people, right? You want to be like, hey, look, check it out. What do you think? Hey, look, check it out. What do you think?
Yeah.
So people, you kind of want to go show it to Jensen too. Yeah. Hey, Jensen, look, I did this. What do you think?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it was really cool. I think it's interesting that he gets so involved on all of those different parts. And I've been to several GTCs, so I've seen his keynotes as well.
Yeah.
And so he knows what he's talking about when he goes to all the process.
Actually, that's the other thing, right? Like you can see when he's doing his keynotes, he's not at the surface level, right? He's really, because he really does understand. He spends a lot of time like just figuring this stuff out. And he's just like, he learns at a pace that I don't think most humans don't learn at that speed.
Right. And so he does understand a lot of parts because when it comes down to it, what he's up there on stage and he's talking about, how fast the bandwidth is, how much better it's going to help on machine learning, what it's going to do to self-driving cars, what it's going to do to ray tracing. Mm-hmm. And he can have a conversation with any one of those very specialized areas and still manage to be able to get it, some stuff out there. So it's very interesting.
It's a tough job and it's a tough thing. I mean, having that view of the company, and especially you mentioned earlier, like we're in a lot of different things now.
Mm-hmm.
Like we are obviously there's the gaming side of us. There's people that see the gaming side of our company, right? And then there's people that see the pro side of our company.
Right.
Like there's people that see the automotive side of our company. They don't necessarily see the other side of our company doing computer graphics stuff.
But it's gotta be now that while gaming is still an extremely important part of your company, I bet you the non-gaming is almost as big, if not bigger in some cases, in terms of what you guys are doing and innovating on.
The interesting thing for us is we're able to leverage across things, right?
Okay.
So one of the problems in robotics and even automotive and stuff is, hey, how are you going to train these things?
Right.
Hey, well, we have these things that we've been doing. We've been creating these virtual worlds.
Right.
What if these things were training in the virtual world? And then, you have Isaac Sim or Drive, so you're simulating the environment for this AI to go and be in this environment as opposed to being on the real roads testing out your AI, right? Like we're able to leverage these things across and we try to do that as well as because we see from our point of view, we see a lot of these things and we try to.
So you find the connection between the dots between all these different pieces and say, how does this connect to that?
Yeah, I think NVIDIA does a good job of that. I think there's a lot of smart people at NVIDIA that kind of say, hey, wait a minute. These are similar problems.
Right.
Right. These are related problems.
Okay.
Maybe it comes from some of our HPC.
Right.
There's a lot of people in HPC kind of think about these things, right? When you think about some of the HPC stuff, network problems like is related. You can reframe a problem to something else, but it's like the core thing is kind of the same, right? And you end up with some of that kind of situation where it's like, hey, wait a minute, you're trying to simulate the world in both of those places because you know, you're doing it for different reasons and different accuracy levels, but hey, they're similar.
Yeah. Well, I know, you know, we're not dissimilar. We have the architects and we have the visual effects for example, and we have to solve some different problems for different people, but we find relationships and sometimes we come up with a solution that's better for both.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, ray tracing is perfect, right? So actually, you see it here. You talk about, hey, ray tracing and RTX is everywhere. But it's across multiple industries, right? Film, architecture, design.
Automotive.
Automotive design. I was just saying design in general, like the headphones you're wearing are design. But scientific visualization, healthcare. Actually, that's a new one.
Ray tracing.
Yeah, exactly. This is new for me, too. Okay. I was like, really?
Yeah.
So there's companies like Siemens and things like that that are getting involved in ray tracing because they're, and apparently they've been doing this for a while, but, you know, to help doctors, to communicate with patients is one reason, because when you show them stuff, it looks more photoreal. So as opposed to some of the diagrams, they get some more realism to it. Mm-hmm. But they also kind of take some of these things to help guide surgeries and things like that. Because, you know, when you're ray tracing, it's more, you get much more of the information as to, wait, is there a path there, safe path there or not?
Interesting.
Yeah.
I also found out about ray tracing with audio.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yes. Audio is a ray tracing. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Because you got to bounce things around.
Yeah, in fact, we were using it for our VR, like our VRWorks audio.
Right.
It was using optics and we're just, it's
ray tracing.
Sound propagation, yeah.
And you don't need that many rays.
No, it's, don't need that many.
But you can get much more immersive sound through ray tracing the space that, or the virtual space you're in.
Those are good. Those are perfectly right for what we're talking about, you know, reframing the problem.
Yes.
It's like, okay, so in ray tracing, we worry about the light source.
Right.
We worry about where things bounce and we have our pinhole camera where we're doing that reverse path tracing thing.
Right.
In audio, you have the sound source.
Right.
Like a light source.
Right.
You have your headphones or your ear, your sound place where you're getting it.
Right.
It's kind of not exactly a pinhole camera, but wait, that's where the sound is going.
Right.
So you kind of do the same kind of algorithm of saying, I care about what I'm going to hear.
Right.
I'm going to bounce it out over these surfaces.
To find
and I'm going
to
find the source of the audio. Oh. It's kind of like, hey, that sounds similar.
Right. But then every bounce creates a reverb and then scattering of sound.
Yeah, that's the difference, it's right? The material properties are different.
But it's very similar. You can think of it like, you know, the light, you know, you get an echo because it's a bounce of light and that's like a global illumination or a caustic, you know?
Exactly. Like, so your specular surfaces or some surfaces bounce more audio, some surfaces absorb more audio.
Yeah.
Diffuse surfaces absorb more light, specular bounce more light.
Right.
It's like, hey, wait a minute.
Directionally and
conceptually,
all of a sudden,
you start mapping these, like, hey, you know, these are similar.
Yeah, it's really cool. I think it's really interesting to think about solving those different problems and using ray tracing to do that. So, optics ray tracing is not just going to, the RT cores are not just going to help this. I mean, even Phil Miller was telling me, it's like, you know, we could, now that we're ray tracing is like free, right?
Yeah.
On these cards.
Yeah.
You can do a lot more things. Like, for example, he had come up with the idea, like, I can, you know, if you're working in a normal 3D application and I want to put this glass on this table, right? And you can try to snap, but sometimes snapping doesn't always work very well because you got to get a vertex to a vertex to snap.
Okay.
But if this is a full surface with ray tracing, you know where this is and that snapping can happen like instantly because of ray tracing.
Right.
So ray tracing can actually completely, if you think about it as something functional for what you're doing in 3D, it's like, we'll just ray trace. Collision detection.
But that's basically collision detection.
But collision detection is much faster with ray tracing.
That's maybe.
I
haven't thought about that. But it's first hit.
Right. It's much faster with.
Yeah, it's your closest hit.
Right.
It's your closest hit. Yeah, you're just checking.
You know, any kind of hard body surface stuff, you can just ray trace that problem and then you don't have to worry about the collision stuff.
Yeah.
So, yeah. All right. So we did cover, you know, you going all the way up to the VCAs and the grid stuff, right? So let's keep going because
keep going. So then I worked on optics. I moved over from some of that stuff. I did the VCAs and then I did our DesignWorks stuff, which is basically our SDKs for like the pro space. We just kind of packaged them and we called them DesignWorks, but that was our video our technologies, our ray tracing stuff. We had a bunch of stuff for large scale displays. So if you want to take, if you want to have, let's say, I don't know, 30 displays,
right,
or 50 displays or whatever, and you want to have them in some sort of pattern or some mosaic, and you want to sync them all, and you want to have multiple systems drive them because you can't even put enough GPUs in one system to drive all of them.
Right.
And it, you know, it can be, so we had some of that technology, scalable Viz stuff. So yeah, it was kind of packaging for that. It was, or just kind of more and more marketing name for that stuff. So I did, I managed that for a while.
Right.
And then I moved on to all the optics team. That was the, that was been the, that has been the very interesting thing for me working on. That's where I got like really deep in ray tracing.
Right. Yeah. So I'll explain what optics is, where that started.
Oh gosh, yeah. So optics started many, many years ago. So Steve Parker, Keith Morley, Dave Lupke, a bunch of these people that are at NVIDIA kind of wrote this paper about a new programming model where you say, hey, so, and it was kind of like OpenGL where you have these shaders. So you have programmable shaders for ray tracing. Say there's a closest hit shader, there's an any hit shader, there's a well, it's intersection. You can write your own custom intersections.
Sure.
So this, this, this programming model that says if you write these shaders, you let and you use this API, there's a compiler. So optics is a compiler.
Okay.
And so people compiler basically takes code and then generates other code. Assembly, usually, or SAS.
Something fast and efficient.
Yeah, and so it takes that and it creates this GPU code. It's like, hey, you do that. Mm-hmm. We will take your code. Mm-hmm. We have some of our code that's, you know, how we do intersections and things like that optimally on the GPU. We'll put that together and we'll produce output. Then the GPU can be really fast.
Right.
Right? So this was created. And this API was put out there.
Okay. Got
a lot of, like, referenced many times.
It was, and it's different than the CUDA API. Right,
or is it's it a think of it like a CUDA library. It's
okay.
It's, so we have a lot of CUDA libraries. Like there's a BLAST library. There's a basic linear algebra.
Right.
So for an image library. So CUDA is a language. You could program directly to CUDA, right? And Vin Chaos did that, right?
Yeah,
you could program directly to CUDA,
right?
Or you could use some of the libraries.
Okay.
Some of the libraries in theory help you simplify, depending on how big, how thick, or how thin they are. You can choose to use them, not use them, or you can program directly to CUDA, right?
Okay.
We let That's the other thing about NVIDIA's business model is we let you engage at whatever layer you want.
Kind of thing. Because I remember our very first GPU render that we wrote, I think it was 2007 or something like that, was before CUDA even existed.
Oh.
And so we hijacked...
floating point programmable shaders.
We hijacked a shader and like inserted ray tracing into the shader.
Yep. People were doing all kinds of funny
Things. Pretty hacky. Yeah. But we were like, no, we can do this. And then CUDA came on. I was like, okay, well, that just changed everything.
That's what happened, right? You talked about the ecosystem and growth. So,
right.
You know, once programmable shaders were put out there, developers started doing things with it. All sorts of very
that you didn't even knew they were going to do.
We didn't think about those applications, right? So that's pretty cool. That's why I went. That's why I like working with developers.
Right.
So I started working on optics for a while there.
Yeah.
And you know, that was working with all the partners. And,
right.
And you know, and RTX was coming.
Right.
So I was very making sure we were kind of laying the groundwork.
Yeah, because optics, I mean, RTX, to really take advantage of RTX, you need to either take care of... Well, you
those
can
are
use
the APIs.
You can use, you can say, like the, we mentioned before,
DXR.
DXR and
Vulkan,
all the
Vulkan. Vulkan extensions, and we have optics.
Optics, okay. Yeah.
So optics speaks CUDA.
Right.
Vulkan extensions
speak
Vulkan. speaks Vulkan, and DXR speaks DirectX, right?
Right, yeah.
But yeah, so so the optics was kind of this API that was there,
right?
And it was used in scientific applications and other. Yep. There were different people using it.
Yep.
It was maturing, and we learned a lot of things along the way. We actually probably rewrote the back end of optics multiple times, but we maintained the API.
Right.
That API maintained. I mean, we added new features and little things changed.
But yeah, there was tons of features. Like, for example, we've added the first, I think one of the first things we did in optics was before any of that. We just added the optics denoiser, right?
Yeah.
So the denoiser is just
was a new feature. Exactly.
A feature, and we just added that right from optics. Yeah.
So at SIGGRAPH, we announced optics 7.
Right.
And so that's a breaking change to the API.
Really?
Yeah. So, but that was, you know, it was, we kind of worked with Chaos and our other partners to make sure we were building the right thing. Because we learned a lot about optics and stuff. And so when we work with Microsoft and stuff, sure. We were able to put those learnings into DXR.
Right.
We were able to share our learnings, and Microsoft obviously brought their knowledge of DirectX and whatnot. And so we were able to combine and do some things there, and we learned. So we created a slightly different API, and the world was a little bit different, right? OpenGL was around as more higher level API, and Optics was kind of like closer to the OpenGL level,
right?
Where Optics was managing a bunch of memory and buffers and things like that,
right?
And state,
right?
And so, fast forward, application developers are a lot smarter about GPUs in general, are doing a lot more. They understand a lot more, and they want more control,
right?
Because then they can kind of innovate at their pace and things. So we kind of, we have Vulkan, which is a lower level kind of thing compared to OpenGL, for example. And Optics was still kind of at that level until Optics 7.
Got it.
Optics 7 kind of gave us a chance to go, hey guys, we have all the stuff there and we're supporting DXR and Vulkan. Let's kind of take those learnings and print it back into Optics.
Right.
And so now Optics is at a kind of at that level as well, where the application developer manages the memory, the application developer manages the state, and so they're kind of in more control and can do. The advantage of that is for the actual end artist is that the steps removed type thing, because you got to find the right balance.
Right.
Like writing all the way in assembler, really hard, but how fast can you innovate there, right? So you want to be a little higher up than that. So, so how far up do you go? So there's a balance there.
But it's interesting that, for example, it compiles the code for every scene, right? In some ways, like in Optics, right? Or when we're ray tracing, there's always that moment where it's like compiling, right?
So
it optimizes itself specifically towards us. There's the condition of the
things, and some of those were unnecessary, and that's what Optics 7 also helps with that.
Okay,
because the actual choice of compiling is more to the application now and not to Optics. Because Optics, the application has more information.
Got it.
Right? V-Ray has more information on what's happening in the environment, what's happening on the scene.
Right.
It can decide if I should compile now or compile later.
Okay.
Right? And so before it was kind of like, Optics would be like, oh, I don't know. I got to go compile now because it needed some more information. I need to redo some stuff.
Right.
And now it's more in the hands.
Good. Because
you get to basically deliver a better experience because you're in more control.
There's less delay between hitting render and first pixel, which is what it was. Because before there was a delay because it was compiling it. Now, if it's accelerating the scene,
sometimes you compile. So Optics had this.
Right.
We introduced this a little while ago where you pre-compile your shaders and you just cache them.
Right.
So really, it's just zero compile.
Right.
There is no. But there are other issues for the time to first pixel.
Right.
Some of the issues with time to first pixel is being able to load all your textures into memory before you did anything.
Right.
Now you can basically kind of do virtual textures.
Right.
So you don't have them, but you say, hey, I want to start ray tracing. So you start right away.
Right.
And then for the texture, when you hit one,
then you
don't have it, you go get it.
Right.
And then you keep going.
Right.
So that reduces your time to first pixel a lot.
Right.
Like caching the shaders was part of it. Right.
Right.
Like making them separate modules, putting them in a cache so you don't have to go compile them every single time.
Right.
So, but those things are, Optics has been moving and cracking the nut of production rendering.
Right.
And adding a bunch of things. So it's just evolved over this 10 years or so.
Right. Yeah.
It's a mature API.
Yeah. It is. It is indeed.
Or more mature than we still have a long way to go. I mean, there's lots of things that, still should be worked on.
Sure.
Right? There's things that, still unsolved problems.
Right.
That need to be worked on.
So, okay. So you were mentioning to me just before, SIGGRAPH's like, I've got a new role now.
Oh, yeah.
I've got a new thing that I'm doing. So what are you doing right now?
Oh, so now I'm responsible for all our SDKs. I'm back to more developers, still in the developer land.
Right.
But so I'm responsible for product marketing.
Product marketing for SDKs.
SDKs.
Yeah, okay.
For developers, right? So it's like, hey, we have our SDKs for AI, our SDKs for, let's call it RTX or for the ProViz market, our SDKs for gaming, our SDKs for automotive, drive.
Right.
So I'm kind of responsible for a bunch of that. I mean, obviously I can't do it myself.
Right.
I have a team.
Sure. Yeah.
And so the team kind of specializes in these different areas.
Right.
But it's kind of changed. I don't, like with Optics, I was deep in one area.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm kind of broad.
Right.
So I get just enough on a bunch of different things. And that's why I'm like spending a lot more time on the AI stuff recently.
Interesting, because you're learning more about how that works and what's going on.
Yeah.
It's kind of cool to be able to branch out a little bit and find out, because now that you knew so much about optics as an example, and then all of a sudden you'd have to move over to this area, and now like, huh, I guess I got to learn about drive.
I got to learn about automotive and simulation and drive.
Right.
And yeah.
Right.
Yeah, so it's but this goes back to the thing with NVIDIA, kind of that repeated pattern is
right.
NVIDIA, that's what I love about NVIDIA is I've kind of always gotten to new, harder problems. Like, hey, you work on that problem, and then at a certain point, that problem, you feel good about that problem or your contribution to it. It's never solved. Like,
sure.
Like on optics and ray tracing, it's never solved. But my contribution to it, I feel good about my contribution there.
Right.
And it's like, well, now we got another problem for you, a different one. It's harder. It's different.
Right.
Like, okay, let's go work on that.
Right.
So you never get bored.
Yeah, no, you don't. No, you don't. But that's really cool. Well, I think it's cool. I think it's cool that you're doing it. I've always enjoyed it when you and I are talking about solving problems, or whenever I run into you at SIGGRAPH or GTC or whatever, I was like, Hunky, what's going on? I got some. It's like, oh, Chris, we've got this new thing. You got to check it out. And then, you know, like you're showing me the new DGX station or the denoiser, or like you call me about the new VCA and what's going on there. And it's really cool. But I still maintain that it's kind of amazing. It's kind of amazing that, you know, we've gone from that VCA that was a monster, awesome machine, right? You know, and it was eight massive
clusters. We were doing clusters of this stuff. And it's just now.
Now we're doing it on a
RTX laptop. RTX laptop. Actually, that's the other thing. You walked the show floor?
I did.
So this number keeps changing, though. So I may not say the right number, but it's like the number of RTX laptops out there.
Yeah.
It's just amazing. It's really just amazing. I think all the partners see it.
Yeah.
It's like you're getting 2080s in a laptop.
Yep. I have to say, I think John might have done this on purpose, John Eisen.
Yeah.
Because you guys gave us two laptops that we could demo our Lavina on that, right? So because I know you guys are pushing these RTX Studio laptops, which are really great. And so I was like, well, I don't know which ones I'm going to be getting. And I was like, do you guys make it? He's like, no, we have all these partners and we're going to get you a couple of them. And he got me two Razer Studio laptops.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure he knows that I was a big Razer fan. Because these are crazy. They are beautiful laptops.
Yeah.
They're less than 5 pounds. And they've got a Quadro 5000, RTX 5000 in there. Yeah. With 16 gigs of video memory.
Oh, yeah, and the Quadro ones have that crazy memory too, right?
Right. It's like, 16 gigs of video memory on a laptop.
Yeah.
And this is not one of those. The other thing that it's cool that's going on is specifically these studio laptops, because everyone, you know, I feel bad for the guys who are like trying to do some serious VR work or show something, some really computationally expensive stuff, and they had to buy these, sorry to say it, really ugly gaming laptops that would sit there and they had all these big things and fans and like blinking lights and everything. It's like, no, I'm a professional artist. And then now, like, that's what I kind of liked about the Razers. Like, while it still lives in the gaming world, it's actually a beautiful laptop. Yeah. And these new...
The industrial designs.
Design. And so you have these very nice-looking laptops that are super powerful.
Yeah.
And now finally, like, it's like, yeah, this is great.
Max Q.
So what's, tell me about Max Q.
So I don't know if I'm going to do it justice, but Max Q, actually that term comes from space flight. When you launch a rocket, you hit Max Q. Hit Max Q. There's like it's the optimal point.
Okay.
And so the big thing, and you know, actually I think Jensen invented Max Q.
Okay.
Like, talk about his involvement, right?
Right.
It's like,
okay.
And Max Q, the idea there is for each chip.
Yeah.
Because they're slightly different in the manufacturing process. There's slight variations. I mean, they're all like 99.9% the same.
Mm-hmm.
But there's things. And so the idea is for each chip,
mm-hmm.
and but you know, like the big one, like the 5,000, 4,000, mm-hmm. 6,000, what you do is you put enough power
mm-hmm.
that you get the maximum perf. You're optimizing perf per watt. So it's not just looking at perf and ignoring power.
Right.
Max Q is about looking at both and getting the maximum performance out of your power capability.
Right. Because you can't put a 300 watt GPU in a laptop. Just no. But you can get you can get the most out of the wattage that you can allow that.
You can get the most out of it. I think the idea there is also like and you're smart about picking which GPUs you put in there, because I'm guessing that like some of the bigger, and this I should be careful if I say something wrong here, but it's like I think like you could take a bigger chip, feed it a little less power or less power, and get more output out of it than if you had, let's say, a smaller chip. You'd have to feed it more power in order to get equivalent output.
Right.
It's kind of like your V8 versus your four cylinder.
Right.
Right. You can get, you know, you kind of don't have to put as much into it. Like.
Right. Yeah. I get it. So you take a V8, but you throttle it way down, and it becomes more efficient.
Something like that. Yeah. But the benefit for us is that, hey, these, you know, NVIDIA GPU engineers and stuff that figured this out. It was a hardware software. So it was like a full stack problem, right?
Right.
Talking to the OEMs and the laptop. But then at the end of the day, you end up with these really beautiful laptops that actually have great battery.
Right.
They actually have good battery life.
Yeah.
Right. And when you plug it in, you actually get better perf.
Right.
Do you notice that when with your RTX laptop, you plug it in, you get more perf?
Yep. Because it has all that power it. Yeah. Well, cool. We are over an hour. I don't know if you know that it went that
fast.
We're
chatting for an hour.
Now, you have a couple notes. You wanted to talk about a couple things?
Oh, no, I think we're good. I was, what was I going to, yeah, I was going to say one thing that, so at the open problems in real-time rendering.
Yeah.
So this was something I took a note because I wanted to talk to you about because I thought it was interesting.
Yeah.
So our research guys, they put out this breaking research thing, and it's like they're showing 7,500 lights.
Yes.
They're moving around, and they're ray tracing that stuff in real time.
Yeah, we can do that. Yeah. We can do that because of the way, yes, Lavina can do it as well, because we have something called the adaptive lights, right? And I actually wrote a whole blog post about
it. Oh, you did? Okay, cool.
And so it was a huge problem. It's a very common problem in ray tracing, but we're very smart about the way we do it. And so we can actually put in pretty close to indefinite amount of lights into a scene and not lose performance. And the reason being is that we're very smart about how we
choose.
Yeah, and so we know we use our light cache to get a general understanding of the scene of what's out there, and then it was like, okay, based on this information, if I'm here, pick 6 lights per ray, right? And then it only picks 6 lights that it needs to consider, but then it'll switch to the next 6 lights, and then in the end, you end up averaging all the lights, and so it looks perfect. But yeah, it takes, you can do a lot of the lights.
Interesting.
You can do a lot of the lights. Yeah. And that's cool. Yeah, it was a big thing that I was like.
Yeah, I just thought you'd find that interesting. The other thing was this article I read in The Economist, which I thought was just kind of, this is one of our on the street type conversations, where it's like talking about how there's a way to, they're applying electric or something to basically create these really thin lenses.
Okay.
So, because you know when you do prescription glasses or something, as an example, you have really thick, because light basically bends.
It's a refraction,
It's refraction. So you get these, refraction. And so you get these, to create these focal points, you kind of have these prescription and these guys, you know, kind of sand thing.
And I try to get the highest index of refraction lenses so that my glasses aren't like bottle rockets.
So the thing that the technology is, they are applying some sort of, I don't know if it's electrical or if it's a physical thing, but they're basically on really thin lenses, they can get huge index of refraction type stuff or negative or low. And I'll send you an article on it. I can't explain it right now, but this is one of those interesting things for me. It was like the application of something like that.
Interesting.
Right? It's like, you know, you see these big lenses that people use for cameras and stuff.
Yeah.
A lot of the innovation in that, like that technology has all been, because the lenses and stuff is done, right? It's like there's not much going on. Like your lenses from 10 years ago are pretty much as good as they are now.
Yeah, right? I mean, they make fluoride lenses.
Some stuff, but it hasn't changed that much. Yeah. A lot of the innovation has been in the CMOS and in the actual post-processing of the images and stuff like that, right?
So now we're
solving. It feels like there's some innovation happening on the actual lens where I think these things will just get smaller.
Yeah.
So you have your cell phone camera with a little tiny thin piece of glass that's
going
to be able to do some amazing things that you could never do.
Right.
So I thought that was pretty cool. I find that interesting.
The first thing I ever did in ray tracing was helping out when I was in the math department, but I was doing some computer science stuff, is helping out someone in my physics lab. This is 91, 92.
because they needed to build one of their physics simulation with a bunch of lenses and lasers, right, to bend light or doing with that date, one of those, I don't know what experiment it was, but there was lasers and lenses, right? But they had to figure out how to get it to do it. So I simulated it in Pavre.
Oh.
to figure out, like, in the sort of refract, it was very simple, but I was like, yeah. So then it was like, that's how it went up.
That's cool.
Cool. All right. Well, listen, Ankit, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Oh, it's fun. I always like time to with you.
And it's fun. And, you know, whenever there's cool stuff that we need to talk about, let me know. And I was like, all right, let's get someone else from NVIDIA on, or you come back on. I'd love to get Jensen on. John Eisen has been teasing me that he's going to try to see if he can get Jensen on it. I'll fly to Santa Clara if I can get an hour of Jensen's time.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
All right, well, thanks so much, Ankit.
Thank you.